Before we start, here's a message from one of our friends.
Give us an opportunity to make you develop our own opinion, you know?
I mean, how dare we? How dare we develop our own opinions? Hi, everyone. It's Ria, the host of Femme on Film, where a guest and I talk about films made by women, starring women, for women. These are films that have often been overlooked or unfairly derided, or where female filmmakers haven't been given the same chances as their male counterparts. And sometimes, it's just a chance to talk about films that we love that happen to be made by women. If you like fun, insightful, and patriarchy-smashing chats about film, come and have a listen. Femme on Film is part of the Comics and Motion Network and can be found on all your podcast apps. So come and join us.
Smash the patriarchy!
Welcome to the show where people share their passions. Everyone is geek about something. I am your super dummy Paul, on a mission to learn from people's experiences. This is Era of Geek. A massive thank you to Ria from Femme on Film for connecting me to today's guest. Be sure to check out her show as well. And just a note that someone decided to mow their lawn right as we started, so you may hear the occasional background hum. But it shouldn't be too bad. Let's get into it.
Hello, my name is Alex Schrader. I am an opera singer and director. I am a comic book writer, apparently. And if you know me at all, it's probably from a documentary released by the Metropolitan Opera called The Audition, which is all about their national competition. I won't tell you how it ends, but it's a good look into that whole process.
I'm just going to say it out there straight away. Opera is undersold. People think it's in a particular niche, but you've done so much. Could you sort of give us this is slightly condescending, but a quick overview of the sort of things that you've been able to do in opera?
Yeah. It is undersold. And that's because there's the stigma that opera is elitist or exclusive, which, you know, there must be some truth to that. But it actually is for everyone, if only everyone could have access to it or decide to give it a chance, you know. So what I've done in opera is a little bit of everything. I try to be very, very diverse in my opera outings. I've performed in big houses. I've performed in small houses. I performed in high schools and elementary schools. And, you know, then I wrote this comic book. And I've also made a couple films of opera adaptations. Opera is so adaptable that virtually whatever your particular taste in story consumption is, there is an opera for you. There is an adaptation of an opera for you. All the genre, all the styles, all of the, you know, periods of music from, and I'm talking about popular sounding music. There's drums, there's electronic instruments in opera now. You know, opera is so diverse, it really can't be shoved into the nutshell any longer. And yet, somehow, I think the public, the majority of the public, seem to have that that impression that opera is old and dusty and far outdated, but it's not. It isn't.
No, absolutely. I have to sort of put my hands up and say I have a limited exposure to opera.
Yeah.
Someone that I used to know, I lost contact with them, but they were an opera singer. And we got invited to a small show that she was doing in a restaurant. They were doing this thing every week. She would come in of an evening, do sort of select songs from particular piece. And we went one evening and it was amazing. I have to, like, just, it was, I don't think I've ever experienced anything like that before, particularly in a small, intimate environment like that.
That's right. That's right. That's a great example. That's a great example of how opera can exist and anymore should exist, must exist outside of the opera house. You know, the opera house will always remain as the foundation of opera and you know, the art form. But now we have to bring opera to the people. We have to bring opera to the many, many different audiences who are not choosing to attend the opera at the opera house. And a restaurant, these pop-up operas, that's the perfect example of how you can experience what opera is, what it's meant to be. And what it is, by the way, is human vibrations, right? You go and you hear and you feel on your skin, right? Someone else, another human who is vibrating and sending those energy, that shockwave into the air. And it joins with all of the energies in the room, right? It joins with your energy. It becomes a part of you. And you're, in a way, you're collaborating with this performance that you're experiencing. And that is why opera is so special and how it can communicate to absolutely everyone. You know, if you can experience vibration, you can receive the communication of an opera singer, even if you don't speak the language, even if the story is lost on you, the emotional information that can be delivered simply through vocal vibration is magical. And that's opera.
I had absolutely no idea what she was saying, but it was an absolute full body experience. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
Exactly.
So how did you get involved? Because it's when in your life did you turn around and go, this is what I want to do? Because it's not, let's say, it's not a typical thing for when you go to your guidance counselor, this is what I want to do.
That's right. No, it's not typical at all. I think that I might never be so committed as that. The truth is that I guess I'm an opportunist, and I'm very much I don't know if you can call it living in the moment, but I think that there's a lot to be said from doing what's right for right now. And so let's start at the beginning. I guess both of my parents are former opera singers. So I grew up with it. You know, it was in the house. It was all throughout my childhood. It was just a part of the natural way of things, you know, to have Mozart playing in the background or somebody singing here and there around the house, you know. So it was a part of normal life for me. And I didn't know that it wasn't normal, probably until, you know, I made close friends in grade school. But even then, while I was familiar and comfortable with music, and music was a part of me, opera specifically was not. It's something I rejected actually for a long time, because I didn't want to follow in anybody's footsteps. As much as I love my parents, you know, I wanted to blaze my own trail and all that. And of course, you know, rock and roll was so much cooler. And so I started a rock band, and we had a great time, but we weren't very good. And that lasted all the way till the end of high school, a little bit at the beginning of university. But, you know, at a certain point, I had to make a decision about career. I had to start, you know, really thinking about where my life was headed. And that's what I'm talking about. It's not that easy for me to make these big decisions that lock me into a choice, a single choice. It was very easy when I met my wife. That was absolutely an easy decision, right? But what do I want to do for my job has always been a question mark. But when I had to go to university, I decided I was going to be a music teacher and have my rock band on the weekends. So I got my education degree. And it was at the end of my first 4 years of university, that I sang in a competition It was a common thing. There's these vocal competitions called NATS, the National Association of Teachers of Singing competitions. And I got fourth place and it felt good. You know, that was the only thing I won up to that point. And I thought, you know, this feels so good. And the feedback is so positive and, you know, I'm getting encouragement. And I was growing up in Oklahoma. And so, you know, it's not typical to choose opera as your career, but it's even less typical there. It's absolutely unique. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a try. You know, I'm young. I have my education degree. If this doesn't work out, I'll become a teacher, which is something I would absolutely love to do. You know, absolutely not knocking teaching. But I thought for that moment, then I would give performing a try. And so I got my diploma. I immediately went back to school for performance. That took another altogether took another 4 years before I won another competition, which was this one they made a documentary about. And that propelled me in a way that I wasn't expecting. I had no plan. I was just sort of thrust into the world of professional opera. And, you know, I got many phone calls and inquiries and jobs arranged. And, you know, sure, I had stars in my eyes. And I was just, I was on the ride at that point. So I know, you know, it has a negative connotation to say, oh, I just fell into this, or it's something that I never dreamed of. That's not exactly true. But at the same time, there are a lot of singers who have to sing. They have to, you know, it's the only thing that makes life interesting for them. I'm not one of those people, but I do enjoy it. Usually I do enjoy it. And what I really enjoy is communication and storytelling, you know, and I know, like I said before, I know how special opera can be in a mode of storytelling. So I'm more than satisfied. I'm happy to be a part of the opera niche. And I will continue my journey as long as we're all having a good time. And as long as we're all communicating and telling these stories. But as I get older and I have kids now, you know, I find myself opening the door again to see what else could be out there, what other opportunities are around. And, you know, so I made a couple movies and that felt great. And then I had a chance to write a comic book with P. Craig Russell. And that was amazing, you know? And so, you know, so I had these opportunities come my way, and it's just been the way that I live my life is decide something, commit to something as long as it's right. You know? And I can't complain. It's worked out so far. I would love to have a retirement plan. as a freelancer, it's not exactly common, but you know, we'll cross that bridge a little bit later.
Because I do know from sort of my limited sort of experience with people inside businesses, just getting there is a full-time job, and you don't know if there's a paycheck at the end of it, because there is so much training for every single little thing just to try and get yourself in front of somebody.
That's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. It's so expensive. It's incredibly expensive just to train to be an opera singer. And even after you've trained to get gigs, you know, to start bringing income to battle your debt, is a struggle that's unlike most careers. So there's a lot left to fate and luck and hard work and sacrifice. You know, it's just not easy. And so when people start on this path, again, you know, you kind of have to love it, or I highly recommend that you love this, because there's going to be a lot, you know, that it takes, that it costs you to pursue it. And so the joy that you get out of singing for people, you know, for a huge audience or for a small intimate audience, or singing just for yourself, that has to be the driving force. It can't be money, it can't be fame. You know, it has to be just your own personal fulfillment in vibrating.
And so to combat that, you took the obviously very wise step to go into the sure thing of creating a comic book. how did that come about?
Yeah, that was absolutely random. So Arizona Opera, which is a company that I have performed with a couple times, they had a competition, which we can think of basically as Shark Tank for opera. They were sort of scouring the internet for people to submit projects that would generate revenue in new and exciting ways, meaning that it didn't rely on wealthy philanthropic donations from our lovely patrons, which is how American opera is funded, essentially. Without these huge donations, there would be no American opera. So, or not the way that we know it. So these, I think they got about 200 applications. I was one of them. I only knew about it. Actually, I only knew about it because my sister found it one day on the internet, and she sent it my way. And, you know, we both have a million ideas about how to make opera more accessible or more, I don't know, wide ranging. And so we talked about it, and she encouraged me to pursue the comic book adaptation idea, because compared to a production of a live opera, it's very cheap, it's very affordable, and it wouldn't compete with that show. It wouldn't compete with their performances. In fact, it might enhance it, or might be a great accompanying piece to go along, a good souvenir to go with attendees of the opera. And so I did that. I submitted a business plan. I researched just on Google, because I had never done anything like this before. I just Googled how to make a comic book and how much it would cost. What do you have to pay people? That's very important to me as a freelance performer and director. You got to get paid your fee. Don't let anyone undervalue you and your talent and your time. So I put all that into my business plan, and then I made a video, which they tell me is absolutely hilarious. And lo and behold, I was selected as a winner, and I got a small cash award, which basically became my fee to write the thing, and then it was up to me to go and recruit artists to put the book together. To their credit, they absolutely helped me whenever I said I needed help, but they didn't know what they were doing and I didn't know what I was doing, but it was my idea, you know, so kind of the responsibility was on me. When I needed, you know, they had to draw up legal contracts. They had to finalize the scheduling of all this, and then COVID happened. So all that was out the window, but they were absolutely ready to figure it out with me. And I can't speak highly enough for that, that supportive, collaborative environment where, you know, this was not on the top of their list, because they're an opera house, you know, they're an opera company. They present operas. And yet making this book come to life was important to them. And I could tell, because they were willing to do whatever needed to be done. And I think that's why we got such good artists. And that's why this book is so beautiful and glorious and got huge in terms of their attention, their attention in the media. This was a big deal. They got tons of national and global press coverage. And so I think all the hard work really paid off.
Yeah. Well, as of recording, the Kickstarter ended just under a week ago, I believe, and you doubled your target, which is incredible.
Thank you. Yes, we did. I don't know what to say. I have never created a Kickstarter before. I backed several, but we were all blown away. We were funded in, somebody told me it was 36 hours. I know it was less than 72. Whether or not it was 36, I don't know. But we were funded basically immediately. And so then it was sort of riding the wave. You know, we would let people know that we're funded. You know, it's no longer sort of begging for pledges, but like, this is happening. So if you want one of these, come on. And it was just a wild ride. We had David Hyde of Superfan run our Kickstarter. He was also PR guy for DC and Dark Horse. So he absolutely, you know, is expert in that. But the Kickstarter was just sort of awe-inspiring, you know, like it felt so good. It felt so satisfying, fulfilling for people to say, yeah, I want that. You know, for me to convince Arizona Opera that this was a project worth pursuing, for them to say, yeah, you're right, let's do that. And then PKG Russell and Aneke and Hassan Otsman Elhaug all say, yeah, we think we want to be in that. David Hyde comes along and says, yeah, we'll promote that. And then I think we had 829 was the final count. Backers, $43,000. Like, it's a big deal. It feels good. You know, it's kind of like, it's almost like when I got fourth place the first time for singing. Like, this could be the start of something for me. This sort of positive response feels good. And since I like it, since I enjoy this, I absolutely want to do more. I think we should adapt more operas, first of all, into graphic novels. But hey, now that I know a couple comic artists, maybe maybe I'll write four pages and see what they think. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why not? I mean, how comes you came to choose Carmen for this one? Why did you think that would suit it so well?
There's a logical answer in that the initial pitch of mine was to choose an opera that was going to be presented on the Arizona Opera season, their upcoming season at the time, so that it could really tie in, like, oh, you're going to come see Carmen, and while you're here, buy this comic book. Again, because of COVID and various things, the timing didn't work out. Essentially, that's why we chose it. Among their, I believe, five productions that they had scheduled, it was the most famous. It was the most well-known, widely known, even outside of the opera niche. You know, people know Carmen, or people know the music of Carmen. They might not know that music is from Carmen, but they definitely have some familiarity with Carmen. And so that's it. But in a nutshell, that's why. I do think it was a great choice regardless, because as far as I know, there's only been two other comic book or illustrated adaptations, and one was way back in the 50s and 60s. And there was a more recent one, I think from the 1980s, if I had to, off the top of my head, the English National Opera put out a book, a hardback book. Yeah. It's not exactly like our Carmen adaptation in that P. Craig Russell didn't do the layouts. You know, it's very sort of six panels, and there's six panels on every page, and we just kind of go through the story. Ours is a little more dramatic, a little more dynamic. That being said, I don't think many people would be able to get their hands on that English national version anyway. So this, it was always intended to find its way into as many hands as possible, and not even opera hands, but comic book fans' hands. we really wanted to appeal to the comic book readers, to the graphic novel enthusiasts, the people who choose to consume their stories in sequential art format, to invite them to the opera, to say, here's this story that you maybe kind of know, that you might be interested in, you know, flip through, it's beautiful, it'll catch your eye, and then you're sucked in. You read the whole thing, and then you say, hey, that was great, why don't I go see the opera? Why not? You know, might as well. Now I know the story, I'm kind of intrigued, nothing else to do, you know? So come on, this opera, especially Carmen, is very timely in its message, which is all about women's autonomy. And so come on and see what you think. And then discover that you already knew the music of Bizet, this powerful, dramatic, captivating score that he wrote. And boom, you're an opera fan, just like that.
It's funny, it's sort of, we kind of talked about it, it's like a niche within a niche within a niche, but they are sort of, in a weird way, sister niches, because it's all about storytelling. It's storytelling, yes, in a way that isn't obvious, as it were. So yep, although it kind of seems a little bit strange, it is kind of a natural partner in a weird way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The niche, we called it geek culture before, like the fans of a particular mode of storytelling, I feel like are more adaptable to those other niches. They're more open to the other niches. You know, mainstream tend to want to stay in the mainstream. There's nothing wrong with mainstream. I love mainstream. But being a geek, being a subculture fanatic, I don't know. Is it respect, or I admire, or at least I understand the mindset of the other niches, even the niches that I don't particularly follow myself. And in that way, I feel like we've already got something in common. We've got an understanding, even without a full, you know, top to bottom, maybe appreciation for the other niche. We know what that's like. And that was exactly, and, you know, comics and obviously film have huge, huge followings. They're comics is $1 billion industry. And opera would do well to sort of build some bridges to those other fan bases, if only to expand their own audience, you know. And why not? Why do we have to, for so long, opera has tried to not really force, but present itself in the way that traditional opera fans enjoy, right? So this is opera here. Watch this opera perform traditionally. Don't you like that? Why don't you like that? You know, and that's not fair, because when you present opera in a traditional way, you might gain a few audience members who appreciate that, but you're limiting yourself. You're, in a sense, you're excluding the people who might enjoy opera in another format. You know, give opera in their preferred format. Give it to them as a film, give it to them as a graphic novel, give it to them, I don't know, as anything, as a, an art gallery, give it to them as a, you know what I mean? Like an installation that you walk through and you can hear things and you see things. Like, let's get weird with opera. Let's change it completely. Because at the end of the day, like I said before, and I believe this wholeheartedly, opera is the human voice vibrating. And so as long as you have that, opera can be, can take any format, right? No, no. Okay. So comic books, there's no human voice vibrating there. But what there is the introduction to the story. There's the familiarity and the curiosity, hopefully, that will lead people to seek those vibrations. And then you can present your traditional opera, right? So I don't know. I think it's I said it already, but it's long overdue that opera gets out of the opera house.
Hmm. Do you think there are parallels sort of moving into the geek culture world? Do you think there are parallels to this new wave of the MCU in particular, in that they were trying to bring it to a new audience, but there was also hesitancy because a lot of the older audience were just not receptive to it at all, because it's, that's not my character. Okay, it's not, sure, but this is what we need, sure, to get more people in.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, look, what Iron Man was not really top shelf, right? Before the movie, you know, and now he's iconic. And yeah, I don't, yes, I think there was a risk. I mean, they were also sort of bound to what characters they had the rights to, I think, you know, but there was a risk that the fans, the superhero fans, wouldn't show up for Iron Man or heck, maybe the MCU sort of master plan leading up to the Avengers, the phase one plan, maybe that would just fall on its face. Maybe it wouldn't work, you know? So I think there was a risk there that they would alienate their fan base. And for opera to alienate their fan base, I think that would mean like a severe just stop in the status quo. And I don't think we should do that. Because like I said before, the core fan base, the core niche opera fans are these really wealthy donors that basically sustain the life of American opera anyway. And so I do think we can't stop doing traditional opera, but yeah, we can think outside the box. We could set up like micro operas here and there, restaurants, parks, libraries, I don't know, living rooms, you know, where you get little tidbits of all of your Avengers. And then you come to the opera house to see all of those characters join forces for, you know, Carmen. I don't know. we could think of it that way. Absolutely. Yeah. Why not? Or, you know, another example, it would be like Netflix, where you binge your half an hour program, you watch like six of them in a row. Well, that's 3 hours and that's an opera, you know? So if we could think about breaking up our long evenings into shorter evenings, that would be something I think is useful. I think building a larger sort of grander story or event for the opera would be great, because there is no phase, you know, for thinking about MCU, there's no phase of the opera. There's nothing that sort of leads to a culmination. You go to the opera, chances are you don't really know the story. So in the program, there's a synopsis. And so you have to read, okay, what the heck am I even going to see right now? You know, and then it happens. And then 3 hours later, it's over. And while that's really cool for maybe a special night or, you know, a night out, something like that, it's not common enough that it would become like a habit, that it would become something you could do like every month, you know, or every 2 months when the next Marvel movie comes out. You know, it's just not quite sustainable. And I think that's what opera's looking for, is repeat customers, is a growing base. And yet they remain sort of exclusive. I mean, now I'll get into the tangent of like ticket prices and, you know, the language barrier, I think familiarity with the story is absolutely key. But there are so many reasons, so many practical reasons, even if the curiosity is there in a wider audience, there's so many practical reasons why all of those people don't attend the opera. So that's another practical, logistical conundrum. Something like a Feige phase, though, that would be, that's a great idea, and we should look into that.
I think this sort of idea that you've had, it makes headway into that, because it is. It's just bringing more people in different ways and making people think about it a bit more. So let's have a look at you as well, because how did it get to the point where you were thinking, like, graphic novels, this is the way to go? So what is your history with geek culture? Where does it all begin with you?
I am a geek of many colors, but I think my first geekdom was comics. When I was a kid, I remember having comics, obviously before I could read, and I still have, I mean, they're destroyed, but I have them. And so that was the first time that I can remember, besides, I had action figures and toys and stuff like that, but those comic books were something I would return to consistently at various stages of life. I think I was a fan first. I think I learned to, at first it was just something that I enjoyed. I liked looking at the pictures and seeing the superheroes and getting involved, sort of falling into the world that was absorbing me in these comic books. And then as I grew up, I would discover my favorite artists. I would appreciate in different ways and more meaningful ways, the content. And most recently, I find that I'm drawn to the writing, maybe equally to the art, maybe sometimes even more than the art. But then, like, I'll see art that just blows my socks off, and I'm like, you could write anything. You could write anything on that page from Greg Smallwood, and like,
yeah,
it'd be great, So my appreciation for comics started sort of in ignorance and unquestioning, sort of just, I like that. I definitely went through like a guilty pleasure phase where it was no longer cool to read comics. It was childish, and it was something that people gave up for whatever reason, I don't know. And then thankfully, I removed the guilt part of that, and it became just pleasure again. And then, like I said, it just became more meaningful. It became more sort of, I'm not a connoisseur per se. that's a really lofty sentence, wasn't it? but I have particular tastes now. I'm not so much into random superheroes. Like I want to trust the storytelling. I want to sort of get invested in the writer or the artist, specifically. Concurrently, I was thinking about, what am I going to do when I'm not performing, when I'm not singing anymore? And so my first instinct was to write. And so I taught myself how to write screenplays, first of all. And I wrote some of those just kind of for practice, which came in handy when I was later adapting these operas into films. But then, when the Arizona Opera Competition happened, that was actually the first time. So I considered myself a writer, or I knew, I thought I had a knack for writing words, but specifically the comic book script, I had not even attempted. So suddenly, okay, you won. We're going to make a comic. So I immediately how to write a comic book script. And, I got a bunch of how-to books. I got all of the how-to books that I could find, just all of them. If it was available for purchase, I purchased it. And they were mostly good. The overall thing, though, was that there's a bunch of different ways to do it. As long as you are communicating well with your artist, there's not really a wrong way to do it. There's not a format. There's sort of rules of thumb. But as long as the artist gets what they need to participate in the storytelling, there's not really, you don't have to do anything specifically. So yes, so I just started writing. Luckily, maybe I was not inventing very much. I was very bound to the libretto and the novella of Carmen, and really trying to stay true to the story, because I didn't feel like the story needed changing, even updating. I don't think is necessary with Carmen, because the men are behaving badly, and the women or the outsiders of society, you know, the Calais people are treated badly. And so we don't need to massage anything. We don't need to make people seem, for example, sometimes in opera, you have to sort of tiptoe around some racist elements or some sexist elements, just because they're a product of their time. Mm. And society doesn't think like that anymore, for the better. But we don't need to do that with Carmen. The problems that are there are problems for the bad guys. Right. So I took a crack at writing a comic book script. I didn't like it myself, and I started over. And I finally got it to a place where I thought it was acceptable. And this whole time, I'm looking at P. Craig Russell's other opera adaptations, and like counting the panels. I'm counting how many words are in each bubble, trying to figure out the code, you know? I'm also thinking in the back of my head, I'm thinking, how can I make this moment of the opera, this music that takes this amount of time and is this important, you know, is this moving emotionally? How can I take all of that? How can I put it into a script, or how can I communicate it to the artist so that what we get on the page, the final page, is this moment somehow translated into sequential art. And, you know, I don't know how Craig decided he wanted to be a part of the project, because initially I contacted him just to pick his brain and just to figure out, you know, anything, any advice, can you help me do this? And first he just wanted to talk about opera. He wanted to know, you know, who I was and how I felt about singing or about opera in general. And then by the end of the conversation, I hadn't really gotten the chance to ask him anything about comics. And he said, well, why don't I do the layouts for you? And I was like, yeah, yes, yes, of course. So here I was, this first time writer, and I had sort of just aped his own pages, like with panel counts and word counts and all this stuff. I just tried to imitate him. And I was sending him that script of Craig Russell imitation. And he said, this is a total wash. This is not workable at all. Start over completely. So I started over again. He said it in a very nice way. You know, he said, we can do this, but not with this script. And I went back, and then I had to become sort of a more aggressive editor. At that point, at that initial point, Arizona Opera had approved a much smaller page count than we could work with. So I went back to Arizona and I said, can we do more pages? Can I expand, you know, these moments? And they said, yes. Thankfully, they said, yes, of course. And so that helped. We tripled our page count, actually. And so then I went back and started removing pieces of the opera. And me, not only am I a geek, I'm a completist. I'm an annotated geek. You know, like I want all of the little the trivia. I want the dates and I want the weather on that date, and I want to know what they had for breakfast when they had that idea. You know what I mean? It's really bad. And that works its way into my writing, and particularly this comic book script, because I thought, here, you know, hey, it worked for Alan Moore, you know, Dave Gibbons, right? Like, just, you can draw just like a little like label of something in the background. And that, what that means is this like three paragraph footnote, right? but that's not a good strategy for an inexperienced novice writer, which I am. So I took out all the little minutiae and trivia and, you know, Easter eggs, all that stuff, as soon as it was gone, and we could focus on Carmen, right? The reason why we're here is to learn the story of Carmen, not factoids about Spain in the 1820s, you know? Although it's nice to have in the background, we don't need to spend so much time pointing at that stuff. So we refocused, rightfully so, on Carmen. And then I just got out of Craig's way, which is also what an inexperienced novice writer should do. You know, if you're lucky enough to be working with an artist, let them do their thing, let them create, because we're here for the art when it comes to graphic novels. And so that meant, you know, and this is also advice that was given to me from Kurt Busick and other people who I reached out to. I'm like, please help me. I've never done this. And I really want to do a good job. And I have to say, the comic book industry, this is all through social media. I was basically cold calling everyone I got to work on the Kickstarter, everyone I got to do the book itself, everyone who just gave me advice. That was all because I slid into some DMs and said, hi, I'm an opera singer. Please help me. I love comics. And I would say like 99% replied with just, you know, generous offerings of time and advice and you know, support. So that was great advice, though. I said, what do I do if, for example, some of my text has been omitted from the layout? What do I do in that situation? And Kurt Busick said, change the freaking text. Change it. Fit the art, you know? Change the script to fit the art. And that was it the easiest advice to just follow the first time? But once I found that the story is intact, even if some of my words have been altered, the story is intact. The art is beautiful. It's all for the better. I need to get out of my own way. I need to get out of my own head as being, you know, in charge of text and adapt the words to the art. It became easier and easier to do that. And I think Craig was also getting more sort of into it artistically, because his layouts started very basic, just sort of forms and positions, composition, in the first 30 pages, which is act one. And then act two, everything was a little more filled out. There were more backgrounds in there and more like expressions and details. And then act three, basically full pencils. Like just he was absolutely in it, you know? And that was thrilling to see that evolution of collaboration on his part. So I think I learned a lot just by doing. And so therefore, I mean, here we go. Do it. If you want to do something, do it. The best way to learn how to do it is to do it. Yeah, you can prepare and you can go read a bunch of how-to books and you can hope that you have an idea of how to do it before you do it. But really, where you're going to learn how to do the thing is when you attempt to do it. And that's what happened.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, like, someone like yourself, you've, you know, this is something that you've had all your life. You know, you've been reading these sorts of things. You've been looking, you've been admiring the art, admiring the stories in different times of your life. I think there is that sort of sense that people have, you could just walk into it. You know how it works. Why not? I'll just walk into it. I'll do it. But it's not quite as easy as that.
It is not. It's not at all. It's not at all. And it was a little shocking. It was shocking because, like, I know comics. How hard can it be? No, I never thought that. I never thought that. I had before I attempted massive respect for the artists and the writers out there. But I absolutely was confident that I knew the story of Carmen. You know, that's something you're not going to shake my confidence there. And yet translating, adapting that story into a beautiful and, you know, well-told comic book was really hard.
So who signed, kind of a weird phrase to do, but who's your guy, like, in comics? Do you have, like, a particular story that you've always followed since you were a kid that maybe inspired you, or who's your guy?
So when I was reading superhero comics, I've been with Archangel ever since he first appeared as Archangel in X-Factor. And I don't know why I stuck with that character just forever. Right. I mean, he was just interesting to me. I liked the wings and I liked the sort of, like, sudden change in his personality and the way he would battle his inner demons and, you know, his, like, remorse and guilt. And, like, he was angry, you know, and that was interesting. It was an interesting character to me. Later in life, I also sort of resonated with Cyclops, if we want to stick with the original X-Men, because his, like, the burden of leadership and his, you know, they would call him the Boy Scout. It used to be that he wanted to be very, you know, on the straight and narrow path. We must follow the way things are supposed to go, and all of the struggles that he met with that, as, you know, with his foil, Wolverine. And I, in that same sort of vein, Captain America was someone whose the burden of morality, often in conflict with his responsibilities to his nation, or the leadership of his nation. And, you know, was an interesting thing to me. You know, and typically, the art style of the Bronze Age Marvel books were visceral to me. They were sort of they were appealing in an energetic sort of athletic kind of way. The art was easy to digest for a boy, you know, looking at superheroes fighting, you know. And then, you know, Cap would say, like, "Oh, but my country kind of sucks right now." You know, I'm like, "Yeah, what's going on with that? I'm thinking emotionally now." Let's see. I also had one of my cherished books was a collected edition of Secret Origins, which had Superman, Green Lantern, Flash, Martian Manhunter, Batman. They were all in there, sort of in their more modern origin stories. And that was a thing I would read just cover to cover, just constantly. It's in pieces right now, but I have all the pieces. And then, you know, when I fell out of superheroes, one of the things that really bothered me is how many universal restarts, reboots, has happened in recent history. You know, like continuity is just out the window, and it's annoying to me. Like, I feel like it's hard to follow a character for so long, because depending on the universe, and sometimes depending on the writer, everything that you've been following is meaningless. That being said, I really, really like practically anything Tom King writes in these modern times. I really liked his run on Batman, and I like the Batman and Catwoman Black Label series as sort of like a coda to that. And just to stick on Tom King, his Mr. Miracle, while I was reading comics again, it was very casual. I was like, oh yeah, that's cool. I enjoy this. Like, I was reading Saga all the time. And Brian K. Vaughan, by the way, is another of my absolute heroes. But when Mr. Miracle came out, I plunged back into comics. You know, I started subscribing again, you know, and I'm still sort of riding that wave of this discovery of this thing that this storytelling, this story that was there and has been there in comic books and graphic novels probably ever since I was a kid, but it's back for me. It's back now in a really strong way. It communicates to me on a deep level, on a very meaningful level, and that is, at least in part, why I was so sure that an opera adapted into sequential art can be powerful, because the art form of comics and graphic novels is powerful to me, and opera is powerful to me. I know that it could work. I know that it could be powerful. And so, you know, with Mr. Miracle as my spirit animal, I submitted to the Arizona Opera Shark Tank. Let's see. Yeah, those are my writers for right now. I mean, there's many, you know, but those are the two that I subscribe consistently.
Because it's interesting, even just like the way that you described Captain America there.
Yeah.
That's a very different way that most people would look at it. You're not just looking at like the stories, you're looking at the deep, the character, the emotions, the what's behind the story. It's like it's not just the story that you're reading at the time that is resonating with you. You're looking deeper than that. It's an interesting way of looking at things.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, I can't help it. You know, this might be related to the way that I collect all the bits of trivia from stories, but there's always a subtext, always. And maybe this is from my training to learn how to be a performer. But I don't think it's necessary that you need training to sort of empathize and sympathize and dig deeper, read between the lines, you know, about not only what's happening in the story, but why it's happening, and the emotional or political, you know, social, you know, powers at play, the deeper meaning, I think, is throughout comics. I think that's one of the sort of like secrets of it, because it is beautiful and it's fun, you know, to go read a superhero comic and the art is eye-catching, and so in that way, like, you don't have to read deeper. But when you get a story, you know, like Up in the Sky, Superman Up in the Sky, where, for example, people recently were sort of saying, oh, well, it's hard, it's impossible to write a Superman story, right? Because he's boring, because he's good, because, you know, he needs to have the Snyder edge. He needs to be sort of like this powerful, you know, person that you don't want to piss off, you know, and that's not true. That's not true. You know, the fact that Superman is good, is powerful in itself. And to see a person who bears that responsibility and that kindness and sure, superpowers, that can all speak to someone emotionally that's beyond the pretty art or even the action, the fights, you know what I mean? That's always been something that I had, I don't know, early on, Archangel, I wanted to know how he can get his friends back. You know, I wanted to know what was going to happen. Didn't necessarily even care who won the fight. It was always interesting to see the physical combat, and of course, but I don't know. It's not quite a soap opera, but it's emotional. It's meaningful. And you know, then again, all that being said, spoiler alert, just in case no one has seen Avengers Endgame. All right. 3, 2, 1, here I go. When Captain America picked up that hammer, I screamed. That was just such a, like, an outpouring of joy and satisfaction, right? And I said, you can make the case that that's also, well, he couldn't do that unless he's worthy, and so his actions make him like a good person, and you know, all that stuff. You could say that, but really, I wanted to see him beat the crap out of Thanos with that hammer. So it can be both.
Absolutely. Even just listening to you describe it, it is a very sort of operatic way of looking at people, looking at characters. But there, that is the connection. You know, there, that is the connection that goes for everything. Like, yes, there is just the pure excitement of watching him beat the crap out of people with a hammer. But also, there is the deeper thing that connects everything, even if it is in this niche.
Yes. Yes. Because storytelling, right, is why we do anything as humans. We tell stories, we hear stories, because that's what we have in common. That's what makes us humans together. You know, we have to experience the other stories. We have our own stories and we want to tell those stories, especially performers, right? We're creators. But we also want to hear the stories. We want to experience the other stories. It's connection. It's human connection. So if you find that through vibration, through vocal vibration, or if you find that on the page of your graphic novel, there's not a wrong way to do it, to expand your own knowledge, your own experience. You have to communicate with other humans, and the enrichment of that experience of communication is perhaps the most important thing that you can do to improve yourself as a human being. The connections or the stories that you are not able to experience yourself, you can get those experiences from communication, from stories, from hearing stories, from telling stories, just from interacting with other people. There's, you know, so I grew up in Oklahoma. It's really, really common for people from my small town, which is called Alva. It's really common for people to be born there and live there and stay there and die there. And I would say, in general, they don't have a very open worldview. they don't know what's out there. They don't know the various many, many different types of people that exist on the planet. And as soon as I left that town, and I love that town, I have a lot of good memories. I had a good time living there. But as soon as I left and started performing and traveling in Europe and you know, wherever, everywhere, my eyes were open. My life was changed. My idea of what the world was enriched. It became something diverse, but it became something wonderful. You know, the little box that I was living in was broken wide open. And I think some people are resistant to that. I think some people don't think that they want to learn about others, about other lives, other conditions, other stories. But it's so good when you do. It's, you know, eye-opening, sure. That's a little cliche. It's life-changing. It's life-improving. The community expands. You know, we can think about it like niches. Honestly, your little niche where you were so comfortable and enjoying your existence gets bigger, and there's more to enjoy, right? And there's more people to share it with. And, you know, you find you have so much in common with people who are completely different from you. And it just makes you a better person. You know, we have more to say, we have more to love, we have more to participate with. We can help each other, we can feel good together, you know, or we can stay at home in our little cave and be scared. And I don't think that's the way to be. I don't think that's the way. So storytelling and just stories, communication is what humans are meant to do. maybe that's a little broad, but the improvement on your own life from hearing someone else's story is invaluable. It's invaluable.
You can find Alec on Twitter and Instagram at Alec Schrader. That's AlekShrader. As mentioned, Carmen, the graphic novel, absolutely smashed its Kickstarter target. If you were not a backer, make sure you keep an eye out on social media for news on ways to purchase a copy. You can also follow the Arizona Opera on Twitter at AZOpera. And remember to give opera a try. Pop-up events are happening all over, and going to a full opera is much more affordable than you may think. As always, thank you for listening. You can contact the show at Era of Geek on social media, or head to superdummy.co.uk/geek. If you like the show, please do leave a review and tell your friends. You can also leave a review on podchaser.com.